Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Let's see, we have about 58 minutes in the hour to go. So if you are asking a question or have a question or a comment, rather, call this number. We'll get you on the air. It's 888-914-9149. I'd love to talk to you. 888-914-9149. A note came in from Anna this morning, listening in Salt Lake City, Utah. Shout out to all the Salt Lake City and Utah listeners. She says, Patrick, how often should you get your house blessed by a priest? Well, there's no set rule of thumb. I mean, some people never have a priest bless their home. Some people, like me, have had many, many, many priests come for dinner, for example, and bless the home when they're visiting. So you have complete discretion. I think it's a good thing, and the church doesn't say that you have to do it at all. It's recommended if you can, but there's no set amount. And it's not as though the blessing wears out. It's not like if the priest blesses your house that it wears off in 6 months or anything like that. Sometimes, what can happen is things change in your life. People come in and out of your life. You know, your kids grow up, they bring friends over, different things going in and on and around in your home. So to have a blessing, sometimes it is because of things that are happening in the moment. You know, maybe you have a son or daughter at home who's dabbling in drugs, let's say. Or maybe somebody came and visited your home who perhaps brought some negative spiritual attachments with her or him. It could be that there's great turmoil in your life, or that you sense that there's a special kind of attack that seems to be going on against you or your family, or temptations or things of that nature. These are all signs that you could say, oh, well, I think I'd like to have my house blessed by a priest. But again, there's no set amount. I would say more is better. So maybe as often as you have Father McGillicuddy over to have a nice meal, you can ask him, as long as you're here, Father, do you mind blessing the house? I'm sure he'll be happy to do that. Let's go to Sean now in West Palm Beach, Florida. Hi, Sean.
Good morning, Patrick. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
Your family, your temptations, or things that...
Oh, see, here's the problem. You have the radio on, so it's going to confuse you because you're listening to two different time zones there. So if you could turn the radio off, Sean, then you won't be confused by that.
I just did.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thanks for taking my call. So sure. The question I have, Patrick, I have a sister-in-law who was raised as an atheist, and recently she had some type of a spiritual encounter with a priest when she was traveling. And so she reached out to me and wanted to get my thoughts, and I gave her some initial advice, but as I've been listening to your show, I thought you might have some recommendations or thoughts on resources that I could share with her.
Sure, I'll do my best. Can you elaborate a little bit? What kind of spiritual experience did she describe it?
She did. She said that she just, recently had started to wonder about spirituality. And as I mentioned, when she was traveling, she saw a priest in the airport and went over and had a chat with him. And she didn't really share in detail what they had talked about. But when I talked with her, she said she just wanted to try to find out more. And knowing that I'm Catholic, I don't know if she was prepared to find out more about Catholicism, because I did mention the RCIA program to her and actually shared some info with her about that. And she thought that was a little too much, or maybe a little overwhelming based on where she's at.
Okay. Fair enough. Well, one book that I've recommended recently, and I have over the years too, it's just a beautiful book of succinct meditations. It's called My Daily Bread, and it's a small size book, kind of about the size of like a pack of cigarettes. I hate to compare it to cigarettes because it, it, but it's like about that size, it, you know, if you can picture that, or like a deck of cards, maybe that's a better analogy. But it's called My Daily Bread, and it has several hundred pages of really beautiful, short meditations that take the form of Jesus speaking to you. So he's telling you things and asking you questions for your own meditation. Now, it's not from Jesus. It's not scripture, but it's written in that manner. And it's just really beautiful. It's low impact. It's non-threatening. It's just a really neat little book that gives lots of food for thought. And I wonder if you were to give her a copy of this book, if maybe it would spark her to take that next step to say, well, I want more. Where do I get more? And that would be the perfect place then for you to suggest, well, how about coming to Mass? Or how about, you know, let me give you another book. Or why don't you listen to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio? These are all steps that could take place after that. But that little book, I think, could be the perfect thing to give to her.
That sounds really good, Patrick. I will look for that and get it out to her within the next week.
Okay, wonderful. So just so you know which one to get, it's called My Daily Bread. It has kind of a burgundy, reddish cover, kind of a deep red cover. The author's name is Father Anthony Paone, P-A-O-N-E. And it was written, I think, in the 50s, like maybe the late 50s, and it's published by the Confraternity of the Precious Blood, I believe. Those are all ways you can make sure you have the right one, but it's a real keeper. And I would say get a copy for yourself. You'll enjoy it too.
You're right. Yep. Without a doubt. I will definitely do that.
Perfect.
Thanks so much.
You got it, Sean. Thank you. 888-914-9149. How about Barbara now in Miami? Good morning, Barbara.
Good morning, Patrick. And we've spoken before on the annulment subject.
Okay.
And again,
welcome
today,
back.
I was listening to this. Thank you. Today I was listening to the show and I was hearing again individuals calling in. And you had mentioned earlier that you like to learn from people that know. Mm-hmm. So hopefully in this one subject, if you have been through the process, maybe there are things that we can share as to the reality of an annulment process. A, you had mentioned that 90-something percent people that ask for an annulment receive it. I would really like to know where that number comes from, and if that number is worldwide, if it's the United States, because at the end of the day, the annulment process on Earth is handled by human beings. Mm-hmm. And as we know, human beings make mistakes at times, or they might be into something for the wrong reason, and therefore you could have an area where that number is not 90-something percent. So having been through an annulment process, and I could tell you that, A, I believe that it should be obviously two people are in a marriage. If one of them decides, you know what, do whatever you want. I don't care about the annulment process because I really wasn't that Catholic to begin with. So now you're left with one person going through the whole process and brutally being honest about everything that at that moment was wrong with the marriage after reflection and everything else. Obviously, with not having the other interested party or non-interested party participating, it makes it very challenging to be able to, I guess, prove to humans that what you're saying is the truth. So I think that there's things with the process here on Earth that definitely are worth looking into to see how they could be done better. Because, for example, you had mentioned, well, if your spouse dies, then of course there's an annulment. Well, there's physical death, there's also emotional death, and really not caring to be part of the process. Yet, at that point, you know, the person's here, but they're really not here. They don't want to give their side of anything. They don't care. But you just then, the person who wants the annulment is kind of stuck. So again, yeah. I guess what I want your listeners to know, it is not that easy.
I remember our conversation, Barbara, now. I remember it very clearly. And I really can only tell you the same thing that I said there, that is obviously the church and her law can change things. There's no doubt about that. And the current canon law stipulates certain things about marriage. But fundamentally, Jesus is the one who says if a man marries, if a man divorces his wife and gets remarried, he commits adultery. So we have to go first by what did the Lord himself teach on this issue. Now, some of his teachings, as you know, can be very difficult and even painful to have to follow, but they're still true. And so the church, for her part, tries in the law, in the canon law, to reflect the meaning of what Jesus himself taught. So I'm not here to dispute with you about whether or not there can be or even should be some modifications made to the church's law, because there may well be. It's not for me to say in any case, but I understand your point. But what I would say is that the church's teaching on marriage is not something that she has the power to change, because this comes from Christ. And therefore, we have to obey Jesus, even if it's difficult. We can try to make things easier, and that's a good thing, but ultimately we can't compromise what Jesus himself said and say, well, even though Jesus said if a man marries his wife, divorces his wife and gets remarried, same would be true for a woman, we're just going to change that. The church doesn't have the power to change that. And as I recall from our earlier conversation, it seemed as though maybe the point that you were making then was tending in that direction. So I don't know if you're making the same point, but I would have the same answer that I gave you the last time we talked.
But can I speak?
Well, Barbara, I wanted to give an answer to the point that you made. So that's my response to what you said a moment ago.
Right, but that's not my point is the following. I wholeheartedly believe in what Jesus said. Absolutely.
Now, that's good.
How you are put, how, now, okay, we got that out of the way. I wholeheartedly believe in it. I do think marriage needs to be respected. It should be forever. Totally believe all that. Now,
that's good.
When it comes to what happens when, now this is the humans here on Earth, and obviously we're not perfect beings. So when it comes to humans on Earth, and you get okay, what happens when that doesn't happen? So the church has set up the Catholic.
I don't understand what you mean by that. What happens when that doesn't happen? What are we referring to?
What if you have two people in a marriage, one of them decides, I don't want this anymore. And no matter, like the gentleman who was trying so hard to save his marriage, he's tried everything. He holds the holy water. He's not with anybody else. He's doing everything possible. As much as he wants to, and as much as he wants to hold marriage to the degree that it should be, there's another person involved. And if that other person decides, I don't care, I don't want this, as much as someone wants it, there's another person involved. And that's what.
Well, Barbara, this is self-evidently true. Everybody knows this. You're not pointing out something that has escaped my notice. But nonetheless, even though we're dealing with human beings and we are fallible and we do make mistakes, it doesn't change the fact that Jesus gave a certain teaching on marriage that we have follow.
I understand. I think that if I might say this, obviously Jesus wanted to make sure that everyone understands the significance of marriage. And you know, yes, many people do understand that. Obviously there are those that don't, and we might marry those. So in a case like that, I think that the actual annulment process itself needs to be reviewed, be more, I don't know, it needs to make more sense, because it doesn't right now. And again, please understand, you're talking to someone who's been through it.
I understand.
I bring something to the table that maybe, I mean, thankfully you haven't had to be through it, but having gone through it, I can tell you absolutely that the process needs to be revamped.
I know you feel that way, Barbara. I know you feel, and you're saying the same things that you said last time we talked, and I'm giving you the same answer that I gave you last time. I understand the point you're making. Well, I don't have to repeat it. You just said it yourself. You believe that the marriage, the annulment process needs to be revamped. I mean, there's no need for me to repeat it. You just said it. But this is something that, in terms of the finer points of the church's law, that's something that is revised from time to time. But if you're saying that just because in a given situation, yours perhaps, that you didn't get the outcome that you wanted, that therefore we've got to change things, if it touches upon the issue of marriage as such, and the church's honest, good faith effort to determine if there was a valid marriage in the first place, you know, the church can't change that because Jesus established it that way. If you're talking about procedures or can we streamline things or is there maybe a better way to get more information, that's fine. I don't disagree with you on that.
But when you're saying the church, you're actually talking about a group of people. This isn't like when you say the church. No, now it's a group of people that are involved in being jurors. Right. Of reading papers, reading, because they don't get to meet you. You know, they don't talk to you face to face, which
sometimes they do. I've been through the annulment process with other people, and sometimes they do meet with people on the tribunal.
Actually, at least not in Miami-Dade County. I mean, they don't meet with you in person. So you have to write everything down, get all your documentation,
that's
and
right.
present it. Mm-hmm. And then some months later, you receive a letter in the mail, and it's like yes or no. And meanwhile, your ability to receive communion and to live a life that you're not an adulterer is based on a letter you got in the mail from people you never met, who don't know you, who never talked to the other partner that's in question here. And they're human beings, not the church, that are sitting in a tribunal making these decisions.
Barbara, it's kind of like if you had a medical test done and you sent a blood sample in from your doctor. The person who evaluates your blood is never going to meet you, never going to sit down and talk to you, never going to get to know you. But the person who's evaluating your blood work is going to be in a position to determine whether or not you have hepatitis or some other problem. It's not necessary that you become friends with or sit down and have coffee with somebody who's going to evaluate the facts of the case. In fact, I would argue that it's probably better that it not happen because you want it to be disinterested. You want it to, there should be a kind of clinical detachment involved. Otherwise, emotions can get in there. I don't know how else I can say this, that the church does have provisions to modify procedures as necessary. And I don't argue with you on that point, but this conversation is like the one that we had last time where you're not satisfied with that. What you seem to want is for the church to change the teaching that Jesus laid down about if a man divorces his wife and remarries, he commits adultery. The church is just trying to determine if that's the situation or not. And by the way, one other thing to remember, Barbara, Jesus established the church like this. He entrusted these things to human beings. And he said to the apostles, Matthew 28, he says, to teach them all that I've commanded you. So Jesus is guiding the church, the Holy Spirit is guiding the church, but by Jesus' own plan, these matters have been left in the hands of human beings. That's the way he designed it.
As is marriage, right?
I think you see my point, don't you, Barbara?
Well, no, but do you see mine? As is marriage. Marriage, he made a statement, and he left it on the hands of people to marry. And some of them make humongous mistakes.
That's true.
Taking your point, if everyone can make mistakes, so can a tribunal, so can someone who gets married. It shouldn't, you know, one size fits all here.
If I recall, Barbara, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that you expressed frustration the last time we talked because there was not a declaration of nullity granted in your case. Is that right?
But I'm not the only one I know of that.
I know that, but isn't that the source of some of this?
Of course, and having gone through the process and being someone who is very much into fairness and things that are right. Having gone through it, I really feel bad for anyone who has to go through it. And when you're saying 90-something% of annulments go through, where is that number?
I can find it for you. I don't have it at my fingertips, but I would look at places like canonlawmadeeasy.com, which is run by a canon lawyer who answers questions like that. CARA, the acronym is C-A-R-A. It's a Catholic sociological, kind of like Pew Research in a way. They do research and statistics on Catholic things. They would have those numbers. Let's see, who's another one? Dr. Ed Peters, who's a canon lawyer. He teaches canon law at Sacred Heart Seminary in Detroit. He has a blog, I believe it's called In Light of the Law. He has talked about this as well. So the statistics are there. You're welcome to dig for them if you want, and I'll try to do that. And if I find them, I'll post them for you. But anyway, Barbara, I'm past due for a break. I wish I could say something that would make this better or at least less bothersome to you. I apologize if I failed to do so, but I do appreciate your phone call. Thank you, and I'll be right back. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
Welcome back. I have a note that came in this morning from Olga, and she's listening on the Relevant Radio app, and she's asking me a question about an author and a book that this author had written, and she's asking me if I can tell her if she's a trusted writer, and I'm sorry to say I do not know. Olga, I apologize. I've never heard of her. I don't know of the book, and I have really no way of saying yes or no, because I'm not familiar with it. So I'm sorry I can't be of help on that one, but maybe a little Googling will turn up more information for you. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Richard now in Los Angeles. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Patrick. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, yeah, I'm a Catholic. My parents are Catholic. I'm married to a devout Catholic. Okay. My daughter goes to a Catholic school. Years ago, I was introduced to this evangelical Christian church, and so I started attending it. And then I introduced it to my wife and my child, and now we're doing kind of both.
You're doing both what?
I'm attending a Catholic mass on some Sundays, and I'm attending some services on some Sundays at evangelical church.
And are you missing mass on those Sundays?
Yeah.
Okay, that's not good.
I'm not doing both. Yeah, exactly. I mean, and you know, for years I tried to black out like the question in my mind, the confusion. I tried to focus on, you know, what's common. It's the same Bible, it's the same mm-hmm. God. That's what I tell myself. But mm-hmm. but it kind of starts to haunt me a little bit and question if, I mean, from a Catholic mm-hmm. standpoint, am I sinning? Is this spiritually healthy and all that? I know this could be touchy, but I just want to...
No, it's fine. It's a good question. So the two questions you just asked me, are you sinning? Well, objectively, mm-hmm. yes, you are, because Catholics, we have a Sunday obligation, so we are obliged under pain of sin to go to Mass on Sunday, unless there's some serious reason why you can't. If you're in the hospital, obviously you can't. If you're, let's say that you're... baby is sick and you have to stay home with that child and you can't leave the child, and if you stay home with the child you can't go to Mass. Well, things like that. I mean, illness, things of that nature make it so that you can't fulfill your obligation. But aside from that, you have an obligation to go to Mass every Sunday and every holy day in which there's a holy day of obligation in place. You have that obligation. If you willfully choose not to go, certainly, objectively, that is a serious sin. Now, it could be that because you weren't aware of that, or you didn't realize that this was a serious sin, you just didn't go, but you weren't doing it in a malicious way. But now that you know that you have the Sunday obligation, the thing to do is to go to Mass every Sunday. Now, the second question you asked, is it spiritually helpful? I would say definitely not, because if you're at an evangelical church, teaching the doctrines of Protestantism, you're going to be getting error mixed in with truth and traditions of men that nullify the word of God, the kind that Jesus condemned in Matthew 15 and Mark chapter 7. Unbiblical teachings like going by scripture alone. The Bible does not teach that. In fact, the Bible teaches the opposite of that, or justification by faith alone. The Bible does not teach that, or once saved, always saved, or, you know, you can get a divorce and remarry if somebody commits adultery, or the denial of certain truths, like the denial of baptismal regeneration, or the denial of the Eucharist, etc. So regardless of where it is, there will be some admixture of error that you will be imbibing in those services, and that's bad for you. It's like the old saying, you are what you eat. So if you're double dipping, it's good that you're going to Mass on some Sundays, but you should be going to Mass every Sunday. And personally, I would just cease and desist going to those other services, because if I handed you, Richard, a glass of ice-cold lemonade on a hot summer day, and you're thirsty, and just as I hand you the glass of ice-cold lemonade, I mention, by the way, only 10% of what's in this glass of lemonade is poison. The other 90% is ice-cold lemonade. I'm guessing you probably wouldn't drink it, would you?
Probably not.
Probably not. None of us would drink it, right? Because you don't want the 10% that's bad. And if I said, well, it's actually not even 10%. It's really only 1% that's poison. The other 99% of this is just lemonade, but 1% of it is poison. I'm sure you still wouldn't drink it. So if you take the same approach to your Catholic mind, your Catholic soul, your commitment to Jesus Christ and the gospel and his church, then there's no point in going to these services. Even though the people are nice, I'm sure they're very nice and they're very friendly and all, but it's not having a positive effect on you if it's having a negative effect, even though you don't feel it. It's like that 1% that's poison. You still don't want that in your body.
Okay.
You see what I'm saying?
Thank you. Yeah, I got you. One more follow-up question, sure. Patrick. So if I'm going back to, you know, if I may say, being a full-time Catholic, how do I rectify it?
Ah, great question. So you would have to look into your own conscience and determine whether or not you knew deep down inside that you should be going to Mass on Sunday but didn't. And that's where you, in confession, you would confess that and just say, say what is true, obviously. So it could be that you said that you would say, I knew that I should go to Mass on Sunday, but for these reasons, I didn't go. And so if that is, if you are, what's the word I'm looking for? If you are formally guilty of a serious sin, well, God will know that, obviously. But I would definitely bring that up in confession. And I'm not going to ask you how long it's been since your last good confession, but however long it has been, go to confession, tell the priest, it's been this long since my last good confession. And what I mean by that is the last time you went to confession where you were honest and you told everything in terms of any serious sins you might have had, and you didn't hold anything back. Now, if you didn't remember something and you only remembered it later, that's different. That I'm not talking about that. But if you, out of embarrassment or fear or some other reason, if you just didn't disclose some of your serious sins, that would not count as a valid confession. So you would want to, in your mind, go back as far as you can remember to the last time you did have one of those confessions where you were completely honest and you were sorry for your sins, and then say, it's been that long since my last confession. These are my sins. And then you just do, after you've done an examination of conscience beforehand, you just say, these are the serious sins that I'm aware of. Missing Mass on Sunday would be one example. You say the kind of sin and how many times you reckon that you did this sin. And be thorough and be honest and say everything. Don't hold anything back. Now, once you've done that, the priest is going to give you maybe a little bit of counsel, but he's going to have you say the act of contrition. He'll give you a penance. For your penance, say these prayers or do this thing. And then he will give you absolution. And once you've received absolution, then you are good to go, my friend. And at that point, you just have this desire that you will not fall into sin again. Now, God, of course, he knows the future and you don't. So we don't know what the future has in store for us. But thankfully, this sacrament is there to help pick you up and dust you off if you should fall again. But that's the beauty of the sacrament. Jesus loves you. He wants you to be whole and complete and happy. And this sacrament will help you do that. And then you continue in faith, trusting in God and His grace. Go to Mass every Sunday. And I like the way you put it, Richard. You become a full-time Catholic. That's what Jesus wants from you.
Thank you so much. Thank you. This really helped me a lot.
I'm glad. That, you know, go in peace and know that the Lord loves you and He wants you to be happy. And these are the ways in which He will help you get back on track. Let's see. Let's go now to Franklinton, North Carolina, and talk to Cheryl. Hello, Cheryl.
Hello.
Hi there.
And I'm currently in RCIA coming into the church.
Wonderful. Congratulations.
And I just have a couple questions. Thank you. Thank you so much. My first question is, Mary, born without original sin. I'm wanting to know how that happened and how her parents accomplished that through them.
Yes, good question. So let's first of all say that Mary's parents had nothing to do with that. So she was conceived in the normal way, as all babies are conceived, with the exception of baby Jesus, of course. He did not have a human father. So one thing to note is that the Immaculate Conception here does not refer to the way in which her parents conceived her, but rather that from the moment of her conception, God preserved Mary free from not only the condition of original sin, but also any sins of her own that would otherwise happen afterwards. So she was kept free from sin her entire life. So her parents did not need to have any special status themselves, because if that were true, you know, if it were necessary for her parents to be sinless in order for her to be sinless, then that means that their parents would have to be sinless and their parents' parents and,
right.
and so on. So we can rule that out. That's not part of what the church teaches. Rather, the church says that Our Lady was granted this singular privilege by God. And it was, by the way, not the first Immaculate Conception. The first Immaculate Conceptions were Adam and Eve. God created them sinless in the garden, and they lost that through their fall. But they, too, were created by God immaculately, free from sin. So Mary is the second Eve insofar as in Genesis chapter 3, we see God, after the fall, cursing the serpent and cursing nature and cursing Adam and Eve with a series of punishments. And you'll note there in Genesis 3:15, he says to the serpent, he says, I will put enmity between you and the woman, between your seed and her seed, and you will strike at his heel and he will crush your head. And the he there is referring to Jesus, and the woman there is referring to Mary. It's not Eve. Because as you can see, Eve was certainly not the enemy of the serpent. She was his accomplice.
Right.
She had just finished doing what he suggested and with her husband incurred the original sin. So the woman that's being spoken of there is the woman who would be the mother of the one who crushes the head of Satan, and that is Jesus. And so when God there says, I will put enmity between you and the woman, it's an Old Testament prefigurement of the Immaculate Conception, because by being immaculately conceived by God, not through anything she herself contributed to it, God restored in Mary what Eve lost through her disobedience. Eve fell from grace. She fell from being immaculately conceived and succumbed to the devil's wiles. Mary is preserved in grace, and she, through her son, crushes the head of Satan. She defeats what the devil started out to do in the garden. So you can see there's a parallel. Adam in the garden is the first Adam. Jesus, as St. Paul says in Romans chapter 5, is the second Adam. He uses that terminology. He's the second Adam. He's the one who corrects what the first Adam did wrong. Mary is the second Eve. She is the one who is faithful in the way that Eve was not. And there are many other such parallels. But the point simply is that Mary's parents did not have to do anything or be anything. This is something that God did because it was fitting and appropriate that his mother, the mother of the Redeemer, would be free from all sin. He didn't have to, but it was appropriate that he did that. So that's in a nutshell. Does that answer your question? Or is there more to
it? Oh, it sure does. I've come to realize that nothing concerning Mary, Joseph, and of course Jesus is normal in our sense.
That's
nothing
true.
Nothing about, you know, so it comes, you know, by faith. I also want to say I so much enjoyed your books, Answer Me This, and Where Is That in the Bible? They were.
Thank you.
They answered a lot of my questions.
Well, thank you. That makes me
so
happy.
Thank you for writing them.
My
and
pleasure.
I'm going to recommend that our RCIA has that.
Well, I'm very happy about that. So the two were Where Is That in the Bible, and what was the other one? Answer Me This?
Answer Me This.
Okay, good. I'm glad you liked them. Let me offer you some freebies, Cheryl. I have a bunch of articles that are available as digital downloads. They're PDFs. If you go to the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick, click on links and then click on articles. And one article in particular is all about what does the Bible say about Mary's Immaculate Conception. So it's simply scripture. And the name of that article is called Mary, Ark of the New Covenant. So when you go to relevantradio.com/Patrick, click on links, click on articles, and then that particular article will give you a guided tour through scripture about this dogma of the faith, about Mary's Immaculate Conception.
That's wonderful. Perfect. Thank you so much for answering that. Oh,
happy
I
to
do
help.
Have one more if you don't mind.
Well, I have to take a quick break, but if we can do it quickly, then sure.
I'm just going to ask about the flood.
Ah, that's a big topic. Could I take a rain check? Ha ha, get my joke. Could I take a rain check on that question?
Wonderful. I appreciate you answering the question I gave you. That's wonderful. You answered
You're welcome,
it completely.
Cheryl.
Thank you.
Thank you. Do call me another time, though. Call me next week, and we'll take up the issue of the flood. Did you get the joke, young Thomas? Rain check? Get it?
Yeah, yep, I got it.
This hour is sponsored by Ave Maria Mutual Funds, where financial goals are aligned with pro-life values and fund decisions are based on investment fundamentals designed to preserve and grow wealth without violating moral beliefs. More information at AveMariaFunds.com.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
Okay, we are back, and we don't have much time left, so if you've been thinking about calling, call now, 888-914-9149. Let's go to Mary Beth now, waiting patiently in Ocean Grove, New Jersey. Good morning, Mary Beth.
Oh, Patrick, I hope you can help me. My 17-year-old grandson came to me and told me that he likes men and that he was afraid to tell me because he knows I'm very religious. And I said that it's whatever you choose, but I'm having a hard time. I don't know what I don't know how I should do this.
Yeah. He's 17, you say?
Yes.
Well, one thing I can say is that it seems far more common nowadays that young people, not just young people, but certainly young people, are experimenting with same-sex relationships. And a lot of it has to do, as you probably already know, Mary Beth, with the way in which the media, our culture, television programs, social media are pushing people to experiment sexually. And it used to be that this has always been around, this phenomenon, but it was not socially acceptable, and it certainly wasn't promoted and glorified the way it is now. So we're living in a time where so much pressure is being brought to bear on these young people that some of them, and I don't know if this describes your grandson, but it could, some of them think that they're quote-unquote gay. They think they're bisexual. They think they are gay because they're unsure about who they really are and what their sexual identity really is, just because they've been so bombarded by these stupidities from the media, among other sources. So one thing I think is, as a grandmother, that you would have an extra sense of compassion for him and say, among other things, I would say, I love you. You are flesh of my flesh, bone of my bone. I love you. You're my grandson. I will always love you. There's nothing you can do to change that fact that I love you. And I will always accept you as you. And because I love you and because I want nothing but your happiness, I will always tell you the truth. I'll never lie to you. I'll never pretend, or I'll never lead you astray. I'll always tell you the truth because I love you. And one of the truths that you need to hear is that God, as Jesus himself says in Matthew chapter 19, you can begin reading in verse 1, but Jesus says that in the beginning God made them male and female. And this is why Jesus says a man leaves his family, his parents, and he clings to his wife, and the two become one flesh. And what God has joined together, let no man put asunder. So the point there is that Jesus didn't say gay marriage is bad. Jesus didn't say, you know, any permutation on that point, but he didn't need to say it. Because what he did say is, this is God's plan and pattern for marriage and human sexuality, that the truth is that men are made for women, women are made for men. And if you consider even just the body itself, just anatomy and physiology, you can see, anybody can see. I mean, if you consider it, you can see that two men are unable to accomplish what the human body is made for in terms of the reproductive system. So the reproductive organs and the system that is involved in reproduction, it can't achieve its goal, it can't achieve its end or its purpose, because two male bodies cannot accomplish that. The complementarity, Mary Beth, between the male body and the female body, the male person and the female person, is able to generate new life, which means that even just in our bodies, even just at the natural level, we can see that the goal and the purpose of sexual union is ultimately for procreation. And so Jesus teaches this is the paradigm. Now, it doesn't mean that there aren't people who have strong attraction to the same sex. Some people do. But just because you have a strong attraction to somebody doesn't mean you can thereby act upon that. I mean, married men and women can have strong physical desire for other men and women who are not their spouses, but that doesn't mean they can just simply act on those impulses. If you're not married, because this sexual activity is intended for marriage, it doesn't mean that you can just act on this impulse just because it's an attraction to you. Certain things are right, certain things are wrong. Another example, what about two people who are attracted to each other who happen to be related? And I know it's a terrible, gross thing to bring up, but this is an example of what I mean. Why not a father and a daughter? Why not a mother and a son? If you stipulate, well, they're grown adults, they're not hurting anybody, maybe contraception is involved or sterilization, so there's no danger of offspring, just as there's no danger of offspring in a homosexual relationship, would that be okay? Now, chances are your grandson's going to say, ooh, no, that's gross, that's wrong. Well, why is it wrong? Is it wrong because it's wrong, or is it just wrong because it seems gross to you? And then maybe you can help him to begin to see that some things, even though they're pleasurable and even though they're attractive, they're still wrong, and we shouldn't do them. So those are some thoughts off the cuff, Mary Beth. This is a very arduous task that you have in front of you. So obviously, be a good grandmother, as I know you are. Pray for your son. Invoke the intercession of Our Lady. Talk to him about this. I would visit a website called... it's for a group called Courage. It's called courageRC.org. And it's a website for people who want to know more. How can I understand how to be holy, how to be virtuous if I'm same-sex attracted? Or if you know somebody like you do, how can I help support that person but not support him in doing something that's morally evil? How can I support him and love him and show compassion for him and at the same time tell him the truth so that he will be willing to follow the Lord in this area of chastity? So couragerc.org is the website. They have a kind of a subgroup for them. It's called Encourage, and that's for families like you who want help in how to be loving and compassionate, but at the same time speak the truth in love. So just because of the shortness of time, Mary Beth, I'll leave it at that. Hopefully that'll be a good first start. And maybe call me back in a few weeks or a month and let me know how your next conversations go. I'll say a prayer for you both. Let's go to Irene now in California. Good morning, Irene.
Yes, good morning, Patrick. First of all, thank you to your show. It brought me back to in full force to the
Thanks
faith.
Be to God. That's wonderful.
Thank you so much. Okay, I'm referring to a call 2 days ago, I think Tuesday. The lady, Samantha, I was talking about the Eucharist fervor in Kentucky at the university there, Asbury. Yeah. And I found out from that conversation, from your comments, that I'm an immature Christian. And strange enough, 2-3 days before, I was reading, something hit me deeply. Father Romano Guardini was talking about in a meditation before Mass. I was saying that we must school our emotion, our sentimental feeling, if we want to be real believer. The two things are hurting me tremendously because I'm sure in Kentucky or whatever, there are many more people like me that when I go to Mass, and actually I've been in two different parish, and both pastors are incredible, are holy. Their Mass is beautiful. And there is no way. I feel so much awe. I feel so much gratitude. I feel so much joy during the consecration. Or when
That's
I receive the communion, the tears come down, and I don't want it. Because what you were saying is a human desire is to feel emotion about God for, and for spiritual, I wrote some notes. Typically, it shows immature Christians, they need it. They needed this. No, I don't need it. I don't want it. I'm embarrassed.
I think I know what you mean.
Not to show. Not.
In the Irene, please forgive my interruption. If I may, because we're short on time, and I think I know what you're referring to. So I'd like to clarify what I said the other day, because I have a feeling it didn't come across the way I intended it, and I apologize for that. What I meant was that one of the signs of Christian maturity, is, at least according to the great saints, like St. Teresa of Avila, for example, is that when those sensible consolations that you're describing begin to vanish, that the soul continues in faith and perseveres. And what I was saying is that one of the signs of that maturity is where God gradually will withdraw some of those things. Now, he doesn't do that for everybody. And there are some people, some great saints, who have always had what you're describing. They always have the gift of tears. They experience deep emotions and ardent love for God, and God made us to feel those feelings, so your emotions are normal and natural, and they're good because God made you to experience that. So I don't mean to suggest that you're an immature Christian at all. It's not for me to say in any case. But what I was saying is that, and there's a nuance here, and that is that if at some point God were to begin removing some of those sensible consolations, and you persevere in prayer, and you don't fall away, you don't just say, well, I guess I'm not going to pray today, or I guess I'm not going to go to Mass today, that would be a sign of someone who's immature. I'm not saying you yourself are. I have a feeling, just from what you've told me, it's probably just the opposite. But the point was really to say that the test comes when those things begin to disappear and the soul continues in faith. And I hope I didn't give you the impression that I was suggesting that you yourself are immature at all.
No.
I hope that clarifies a little bit more.
But I didn't understand.
Yeah, I'm glad you gave me an opportunity to clarify, because that's such an important thing. Well, please pray for me, Irene. I'll pray for you. God bless you.